Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcon, Sniper Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Yo.
And freelance writer and critic for Rotten Eru.
Hello, hello. Staying alive.
So we're going to be doing a little bit of discussion on the podcast, a little bit, a lot of discussion about spoilers for a particular film that is out in cinemas that everyone's talking about. Tenet, of course, the new Nolan movie. We covered non-spoilers last week, and we're going to be doing a little bit of our non-spoiler discussion later in the program because Rod has had a chance to see it, which will lead us into our spoiler discussion on the podcast. And we're just going to be talking about, now that cinema's opening up a little bit more, what else has been playing. We're seeing some of the classics, some obscure choices. There's been a Fellini retrospective of the Ritz. First of all, we wanted to talk about the sad film news of the week, which is obviously the death of Chadwick Boseman at 43, which no one was aware that he was sick, and he passed away this week. His family announced that his tweet announcing it has been the most liked tweet in the history of Twitter, overtaking a tweet by Barack Obama. We reviewed Five Bloods earlier in the year. We talked about Black Panther, his contributions to the broader Avengers universe last year and the year before. And yeah, this has had an impact, I think, broader than love for the films he's been in and his particular filmography. And this just puts a lot of his films, particularly Five Bloods, into much stronger resonance.
Yeah, this was for me the most shocking kind of celebrity death since Paul Walker, in the sense that it was somebody who is headlining a major blockbuster series that is beloved seemingly by everyone at the moment, dying completely when no one saw it coming, except Boseman was much more respected as an actor. You know, Boseman had a lot of praise for a lot of serious acting roles that, to be honest, I haven't seen.
I think that's been the takeaway, that I need to go and check out his filmography and give it a bit more due diligence.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of Marshall on TV a few weeks back. I haven't seen 42. You know, I need to watch these things before I can speak to him as an actor more broadly. Everyone knows, if they've listened to this show, that I'm not much of a fan of the Marvel films. I thought he was fine in them, but, you know, he has a lot of praise for a much broader filmography that I have no experience in. But the actual impact of the death in terms of the shock is clearly being felt. No one knew that he had cancer at all.
I think that's been the biggest takeaway. It's the fact that he's been filming very physically intensive scenes, you know, clearly.
And between surgeries.
Yeah, and just doing that, no one knew about it. It was just, I had to basically read the news at least four or five times and confirming every half an hour.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
I read this was a hoax. I really thought it was a hoax.
It was the same for me. It was like, Chadwick Boseman dies. What?
Yeah, I saw the announcement and my immediate thought was, I didn't know he was sick. And obviously this hadn't been in the public. It's unclear. Well, no one's actually come out, to my knowledge, and said we were aware of this. So certainly it's very possible that he kept this from his compadres in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And that's why
I reckon they didn't know.
It was his right. And it's incredible to look back at these films that are physically strenuous and knowing that he did this between, as Varad said, very, very intensive surgeries. Of all the films that we've covered, I think he's... My favorite performance of his that is in Five Bloods. It was really moving. And I think the best performance of the film, as we discussed only a couple of months ago, and it brings that into a new light. I wanted to see the new Black Panther, the film we just covered it a couple of years ago when it came out. I think he had a lot more scope to develop the character and his performance in this universe. I would love to have seen what else he could have done with the character. Certainly Black Panther was one of the better Marvel films, and just to see the broader impact he's had. There's a beautiful photo that's gone viral. The father's interviewed at CNN on his 10-year-old son lining up with all the Marvel figures outside his garage and saluting with them. It was beautiful. Many tributes like that are out there.
I think, yeah, we haven't really seen anything with Boseman as Black Panther written after the enormous success of the first film. In terms of writing, I don't think he really had that much to do in the first Black Panther, especially compared with Michael B. Jordan. He really didn't have anything to do, basically, in the Avengers films. But yeah. I think it's clear that if there were to be another Black Panther, they would have given him much more significant material.
But the other thing that's probably come to light is the kind of cultural significance beyond his filmography, that
of
and
Black
how
Panther
he's
now.
Actually paved the way for other actors and you know, other diverse and African American actors as well. You know, the story that how Denzel Washington basically helped him in his acting career, you know, unknowingly because he didn't know him, but helped finance his acting school was a very touching story as well. And they got to meet and sort of thing. So that's interesting how there's a paid forward kind of thing that's happened in his legacy. And he's basically kept that spirit alive by helping other African-American actors really come to the fore as well. So I think that has really touched a lot of people.
Well, yeah, you're right, Virat. He does clearly have a great symbolic significance. I think that's why his death is shocking people and resonating quite, I mean, it would under any circumstances, but I think he has become in this role to be seen as an icon of Black power. And I think given the circumstances in America at the moment, I don't know, I think people are taking this really as a gut punch. Like, here was this mainstream beloved Black superhero who represents an idea of Black and African pride.
Yeah, I mean that's the other thing, right? Especially with so many negative representations of African-American culture on screen, suddenly you have a Black superhero.
I think Black Panther works within the imagery that, and the typical archetypal iconic imagery of many a superhero, and particularly many within the Marvel Cinematic Universe. However, the character, not just for the name, but for the iconography it perpetuates and it furthers, is intrinsically tied to a history of African-American history and of protest, and certainly importantly to me as an African myself, of how we often do not see Africa perceived and represented in the world. And so was so wonderfully here. It was so nice to see, like in a film, like Coming to America or others, a version of Africa which not many people get to see and that which many often in respects aspire to. And that is what Wakanda represents, what Black Panther represents. And it's very important to so many out there. And I'm glad that Boseman had such a lot of it was on here, had such a central role in furthering this and will for so, such a longer time.
Black Panther, I think, was culturally interesting because it's such a 60s creation. It goes back to like the 60s ideas of a big push for reviving African pride, 60s civil rights era frustration and anger at America, and let's define ourselves as African rather than as Americans. There was a big movement towards that, and the Black Panther comic clearly seems, you know, tied to that. It's like this Afrofuturism kind
it was
of
wonderful.
Yeah.
Wakanda, you guys did it. You did it.
But yeah, it was interesting, you know, to bringing that character into the present in a film that connects him with the, you know, this African pride idea versus the Killmonger character who was pushing for a kind of international Black solidarity. I found that interesting.
Yeah, we spoke about this when we talk about Black Panther. I guess this constitutes a minor spoiler for Black Panther, but hey, you've probably seen the film by now. If you haven't, you should have. Yes, Black Panther exists in many archetypes of superhero, but particularly Marvel superheroes, but in all these films, it's always good guy fighting bullies. This was slightly different. Black Panther had a lot to learn from Killmonger's approach and from other approaches, and actually, unlike most core superheroes, had a moral arc. And that's not something you get to see portrayed in these old films. Boseman handled it exceptionally well. And I wanted to see what they could do with another one.
Yeah. I don't want to make Chadwick Boseman's eulogy into a rehash of my gripes with Black Panther. But broadly, I would say that he didn't have the most interesting dramatic arc in that film.
I liked it. I certainly liked it more than any of the superhero arcs in any of the other Marvel films.
Oh, yeah, it was definitely better. Hiring a real director and allowing him to write.
It was a good Marvel film. Yeah, we can leave it at that. But the more important thing about it is, you know, it's so physically taxing to do all that while you're battling something like cancer. And, you know, I know a lot of people have commented online now that
crazy.
Some of that was visible, but actually, no. Not really. It wasn't. And I could see the physical transformations from, like, because he was bulking up and then thinning down again. That is very hard to do in real life anyway, regardless of when you were battling something like cancer. So I just don't know.
I mean, it's absolutely insane.
Otherworldly kind of strength. I don't know.
It's a shame that we're never going to have the tell-all interviews where he explains how he got through it. There's a pretty crushing interview extract that I saw doing the rounds on Twitter where he was asked about the physical training and the bulking up and the getting, you know, well, for shooting Black Panther. And he said, oh, you have no idea. One day I'll live to tell the story. Oh, man. But I think you have to have that optimism that you're going to get through it to go through that ridiculous physical endurance. I think he took a chance to play Black Panther, and why wouldn't you? You know?
Yeah.
Would Disney have cast him had they known? It sounds like no one knew from the sound of it, except for maybe a very select few people. Would Disney have allowed this guy to be cast knowing that there's a significant chance he would have to be recast in the next few years? Probably not. But screw Disney, you know, like if you've got one life to live and you can play Black Panther, I would say, yeah, I'm playing Black Panther.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what happened.
Life to the fullest.
I don't know what happened on that front, but hey, he was cast for a reason and he was great. And they made the right call casting him.
They did. Yeah. We need to watch more of his films. Apparently he's really good in 42. His new film coming up on Netflix, My Rainey's Black Bottom. Apparently he gives a really good performance. Advanced Word is very strong. So I think that'll be a nice way to remember him.
Yeah, it's going to be a hard watch, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to talk about some of the things that are happening. First of all, around town, Static Vision are having their 22nd week of screenings on Friday night. Queer Screen are going online. They're running from the 7th till the 17th online. You know, Sydney are coming up. You can get your flicks in for Sydney's Open Mic Film Night. And yeah.
Is that on Monday?
That is coming up, not next Monday, but the Monday after, just a little bit of a heads up to start shooting. And otherwise, yeah, I think we're seeing also on the festival front, there's a few that are going online, a few that are postponing, and a few that are looking at, particularly in rural areas, doing screenings. Obviously, a lot of institution cinemas included are having to decide now, do we go ahead with limited screenings? We've discussed in previous weeks how the Fellini retrospective has gone, as is the Hitchcock retrospective, and through the Bond retrospective at the Ritz.
Babs Fest.
Sorry?
They've got a Barbara Streisand retrospective at the Ritz now, and which is great because whenever I mention this to people or I'm at the Ritz and we walk past the poster, everyone says, but why Barbara Streisand?
I mean,
Barbara Streisand.
I've seen Yentl, and Funny Girl was great.
Well, now you can watch The Mirror Has Two Faces and a bunch of other things. But no, you should see What's Up, Dog.
The Mirror Has Two Faces is good.
I haven't seen it. Hello, Dolly. It's great.
Hello, Dolly's coming up. Funny Girl was playing like a couple of days ago. Yeah, What's Up, Doc is great. I watched that late last year. Great tribute to screwball comedies.
So, okay. Why are they like they've done the Die Hard?
Yeah, exactly. Why?
Why? I mean, Barbara
Streisand. It's like someone in programming just had a brainwave, I think. Or someone said,
guys, this is our time. We're doing a Barbara retrospective. Otherwise, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, it's like maybe there was a group of people who put it forward persuasively. Like, we promise we're going to buy at least 15 to 20 tickets to every session if you program a Barbara Streisand retrospective.
No.
And they're like, all right, maybe this is starting to look feasible.
The thing is, I think because Barbara Streisand is mainstream enough, but I would probably categorize her mainstream success more as a singer than as an actor. So,
Call Me Barbara's great. yeah, she's more popular as a singer, obviously, but she has a lot of successful films. I mean, they probably just went through one of those bingo things and said, all right, we need an actor who starts has a B and an S in their initials. What were the other choices? Barbara. No, that's unfair. She's great. I think
better than having a Jennifer Lopez retrospective. Look,
Hustlers was okay.
Yeah, on the subject of Barbara Streisand, I heard a juicy rumor the other day. Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie. Rumor is that Alana Haim is playing Barbara Streisand.
But what is PTA's new movie about?
No one knows, but it seems to revolve around things that could involve Barbara Streisand, because it's got Alana Haim, who looks the part, and it's got Bradley Cooper playing John Peters.
He's still alive. Okay.
Bradley Cooper.
I didn't know Bradley Cooper was doing anything. Yeah.
What a thing to say.
In ages.
He just made a movie relatively recently.
No, it was that, but before that, it was this Joy with Jennifer Lawrence. So, like, it seems like it's a big hiatus.
He spent 3 years making A Star Is Born, directing, writing, producing, starring it. Speaking of musical biopics.
Okay, I must talk about the Paul Thomas Anderson movie. Bradley Cooper is playing John Peters. John Peters is the famous hairdresser/producer of Barbara Streisand. He started as Barbara Streisand's hairdresser, and that was his in into Hollywood. And if you've ever watched Kevin Smith's famous speech about his time making Superman, John Peters is a guy who's really into spiders. Anyway, Bradley Cooper's playing that guy.
Okay, that's an actor.
Do you know what I'm talking about? The spider speech?
I don't.
No. Oh, man. I thought you guys would be in on this. I need to link you guys, and this should be a shout out to everyone listening to this on the radio. Look up on YouTube. It's up in two parts. Kevin Smith talks about Superman. It's like Kevin Smith describing his time working on Superman Returns, and it's one of Superman Lives, I think it was called.
Superman Lives, days. Yeah.
And it's the funniest Kevin Smith thing. His natural way of telling the story is so funny, and it's also just a great nutty encapsulation of Hollywood, and John Peters sounds like a weird, weird character. Once you've listened to that, the idea of Bradley Cooper playing him with ridiculous 70s hair and outfit sounds great.
Yeah. I just as a brief segue, stuff to see on YouTube, we talked a lot earlier about Chadwick Boseman's dramatic filmography, and he's a very good dramatic actor. However, some of the best work he's ever done was in a sketch for a Black Jeopardy sketch on Saturday Night Live, which you watched on the weekend, which as T'Challa, which is pure gold. So if you feel like it's been a bit of a shitty week and something a bit funny to pick you up, and it's well worth the time, go look up the Black Jeopardy sketch.
Yeah, the original Karen before Karens were cool. Now, you know, this is the OG reference to Karen in that sketch.
Is this actually the source?
It's the earliest reference to Karen in its modern parlance that I've seen. Yeah. This was like 3 years ago. This
potato salad. Yeah. I don't think Karens were a thing.
So this probably is the source, huh?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Good on you. Said it then. It's pretty great. Although it's actually one of the best recurring sketches SNL have ever done. That and the other Celebrity Jeopardy. Speaking of celebrity and music biopics, do we really need more? Apparently Madonna and a couple of...
I saw that Madonna biopic.
Julia... The rumor is Julia Garner.
Madonna's story is pretty interesting. Yeah. Of any musical biopic, Madonna is probably the one that I'd be more interested in than of recent pop icons.
As long as it's not the same as Rocket Man and Bohemian Rhapsody and every single other music biopic.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, on paper, when you say a Madonna biopic, I think, that could be interesting. But I guarantee you, once I see the trailer, I'm going to say, why?
It's hitting all the notes. It's doing all the things.
And it's going to be called Vogue.
Or Material Girl.
Yeah, actually, it's Material Girl probably makes more sense. But Julia Garner would be good. For those who are there, she was in Grandma. She plays Ruth in Ozark. She's amazing.
But look, Madonna's already had her biopic. This was the video she filmed in the bathtub, but she's just sitting there contemplating her privilege as the pandemic is taking over. I thought that was the funniest thing I've ever seen in 2020. But anyway.
Was this like one of those celebrity...
I vaguely remember this.
I didn't see this. Is this one of those celebrity dummy spit kind of things? Like
the
Imagine video?
Yeah, no, but no, this is actually more heartfelt. This is Madonna trying
I'm
to...
Not mentioning this, philosophical. Chris, what have you done? Now I feel sick. No, it actually, it was nice and sincere. It was just very, very saccharine.
It was just very Madonna. It was just so Madonna. It was like, I'm in a bathtub with all her Christian symbolism and wearing the cross and with like rose petals. And I'm just like...
She's too out of touch now. That's the problem. You know, you can't be a megastar of that stature for that many decades. And
sort of like a finger on the pulse.
I think it's just impossible to do. And she's been at it a long, long time.
Yeah. But she was just trying to be contemplative, be like, there's a pandemic outside. What are we doing here? What are we doing on this earth? And I was just like, oh my God.
Well, fortunately, the Madonna biopic will probably be focused on Madonna in the 80s.
Yeah,
90s.
Chris, like every biopic, it's going to cover their entire life and span their entire history. They're walking off into a white screen.
No.
And then have them rehab and have the early years where they're struggling to be themselves. And she's going to have that moment where she discovers, where she was like a virgin. This is the greatest song ever. I'm going to learn to play this. And
yeah.
Who do people actually want to see a biopic of aside from Madonna? Like, I would have said Elton John, but then I was so wrong.
I have a confession.
Janis Joplin is one that they've been struggling with for a long time.
Well, 30 Rock tried.
I don't know any other Madonna songs apart from Vogue and Material Girl. So
really,
Madonna. Yeah. Aside from what?
Really,
Material Girl and Vogue.
You don't know Madonna's songs.
I think the episode Punish You.
Oh, right. Oh man,
Punish You. We're going to
a prayer.
We don't need to name them all. I'm just going to put a bunch of them in this episode just to punish you.
Okay, I know Like a Prayer. She has, that's fine.
I've never been the biggest Madonna fan, but she has some great. Great songs.
Yeah,
she's
great. I honestly, in a lot of ways, I think she's not, in terms of stature, she shouldn't be ranked that much further behind Michael Jackson. Allegations and controversies aside, speaking purely with regard to her stature as a songwriter and a singer, I don't think she should be placed that far below Michael Jackson. I think she has some great hits from the 80s, especially, yeah. In the 90s, she had some great good songs too, like Frozen.
Yeah, Frozen is beautiful.
Yeah,
it was really good.
But yeah, I got onto this strange tangent from talking about the Babs Fest at the Ritz, right? I like
we've
that
we've gone down the Barbara Streisand rabbit hole of film.
I like that both
you
of
want
you
want to see a retrospective of
right. I like that both of you had the same reaction of why to the Babs Fest. Everyone reacts that way, but. Yeah, the Ritz have been doing some great stuff.
There is a core Barbra Streisand crowd.
Yeah. The Ritz, as you said earlier, they've been doing some great stuff. Like the Fellini retrospective, as you mentioned before, has gone from being, you know, my reaction when I saw it originally was like, where's Knights of Cabiria? So they played Knights of Cabiria last night because the COVID thing is going on longer than anyone had bargained for. So yeah, Knights of Cabiria got added with the beautiful new restoration. It looked amazing. And now the retrospective's been extended to showing every single Fellini film. They're filling in all the gaps of the films they haven't shown yet. And as was said in the introduction speech, this is a very, very rare thing. It's not even in Italy very often that you would see a retrospective featuring every single film directed by Fellini. Because a lot of these aren't particularly well-liked films when we're getting to the latter stages of his career, which means that it's impossible for you to get a hold of them sometimes and make up your own mind. Some of these films are rarely seen at all these days. So yeah, it's a great opportunity. I wonder how many people are going to turn up for the Fellini films no one especially likes. But I love that the Ritz are taking this gamble. I'll be there for as many as I can.
I mean, not liking is a different thing altogether. Knowing about them is another thing.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of people don't even know these films.
Be like, oh, is this by Fellini? And maybe they'll give it a chance because they'd be like, oh, I like Fellini films. I like Dolce Vita. So they might go with that perspective and give it a chance, which could work out.
Hopefully. And because a lot of his latter stuff is being reappraised now. So this gives you that opportunity. The Ritz.
There's a new Orson Welles film also coming out soon, apparently.
What?
Yeah, I read in the grapevine. There's a new Orson Welles unreleased film.
There was one.
The Other Side of the Wind a few years ago, but like another?
No, another one. I've just read recent reports on IndieWire. I'm not sure what the status is or where things are going.
Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it because The Other Side of the Wind took a long time to actually be released.
Yeah.
That was stuck in Wright's hell for a long, long time. As pertains to the other Orson Welles films, I don't think there's many in a good enough state to really release them.
That's true.
The Other Side of the Wind.
But I was still very happy to see The Other Side of the Wind. I mean, there was enough there. Yeah.
There was enough there that they could finish that. But most of the other ones, as I understand it, there's chunks missing. It's all a bit all over the place. But yeah, going back to the Ritz, they're great. The last couple of days before we recorded this show, I saw on Monday night, Grand Illusion, and on Tuesday night, Knights of Cabiria. It really doesn't get any better than that for cinema. Last week, I saw Belle de Jour. Okay, I've seen all these movies before. However, the chance to see them on the big screen is a special event, I think. As we were talking about before we started recording the show, Glenn made the point that you see Die Hard all the time. at the cinema. You know, you see the Goonies all the time when it comes to these retro screenings. I think it's great that in cinema, someone beyond the Art Gallery of New South Wales is taking a chance on films from the 30s, you know, foreign films, stuff that rarely screens. So I would encourage you, if you love film and you feel safe congregating with people in public. I will say on that note that the Ritz are very good in terms of spacing social people out and social distancing. Yeah.
And they're playing Cats. So everyone, come
to Cats
on this Friday night, wear your biggest, most absurd Cats costume. And that way people will just have to social distance from you.
Right.
And that could be the safest screening you go to this year.
The Cats screening could be really fun. I wonder if we're already at that point where Cats would have the cult crowd rock up for it. Maybe
Cats.
We are.
We need
a remembrance of the good times before 2020 hit.
right. When we were all enjoying Cats.
In the 2019 nether.
Yeah. But
I think we almost are. I think we're on the cusp of Cats becoming the new midnight horror-esque.
The Room.
Room-esque. But the Cats has that sing-along quality.
Yeah.
Which The Room does not. And Rocky Horror does.
That's true.
But Rocky Horror always be better, because Rocky Horror is just a genuinely good film.
I strongly disagree.
The second half gets a little boring.
The second half is the boring. The first half is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Maybe we should fight about which musicals are actually worth our time at some point in time.
Yeah.
West Side Story coming out soon, prospectively.
Yeah, we'll see when it gets released, maybe at the end of the year. But But what I was trying to say before is it's amazing that all these cinematic treasures are being given new life, often in beautiful 4K projection.
I agree. I mean,
Orpheum as well are doing some cool stuff.
The Art Gallery is doing the film Redux series.
Yes, the Art Gallery have started screening their retrospective sessions again. There's no Wednesday 7:15 p.m. sessions. Yeah. It's just 2 p.m.
This Sunday, they're doing Salam Cinema by Makhmal Boff, which is great. One of my favorite films. I've never seen it. Yeah, okay. So I'm going.
I'll come. I like Makhmal Boff.
It's only 70 minutes. It's a pretty short film.
Yeah, awesome. Is it screening with a short or something?
Yeah, screening with a short.
Cool.
So you could check out.
Go and see these things. Vote with your wallet. Tell the cinemas that we want more of this stuff.
So literally,
that's free. Yes, go to the Art Gallery, but they all have no trouble packing out the cinemas.
They're not packing out, but
packing out as much as they can. But they don't have trouble packing them out in the pre-COVID era.
For all the creative organizations that are getting guidelines about how to social distance, they're based on the Art Gallery of New South Wales' guidelines. So they're the ones who are out there saying that they've put the template for here's how creative organizations and museums and whatnot can do social distance. So they know what they're doing.
Nice. But yeah, go see.
Yeah.
Go see
these things which you otherwise can't see.
That's right.
Or will not get a chance to see.
Yeah, exactly. It's special to see films in the cinema.
Yeah. I mean, COVID that way has been a boon because, you know, this empty slot has suddenly given programmers much more flexibility and much more creativity and a chance to screen things which otherwise in a regular schedule, in a regular lineup, probably you wouldn't get to see.
Yeah, look, if anything, my cinema year has been probably greatly improved versus what it would have been if all the regular 2020 films had came out. Like
oh
I said,
God.
Grand Illusion and Knights of Cabiria, and it was a 1-2 punch in consecutive days. Does it actually get any better?
Fast and Furious 9, Chris.
You're right. Matt, you're right. Yeah, that probably
But even in terms of film Fight Club, the fact that we could do so many retrospective director kind of filmographies for our show, that's been some of my favorite.
Tom Cruise, go look it up.
But the Ritz kind of aren't playing by our rules because they did a mini Billy Wilder retrospective like a month after we did our episode. And I said, that's not fair.
That's okay. They were probably listening to our episode. So
right.
People listening at the Ritz.
They're like, now you can go and see these films on the big screen. So
go see these movies. We're going to be continuing in the podcast talking all things Tenet and spoilers for Tenet. So you've been warned we warned you in the podcast. But anyway, seek us out on iTunes and Spotify. We'll be back next week and enjoy movies. Go to the cinema if you feel safe doing so.
Otherwise, see Cats, I guess.
A lot of these things, including Cats, God help us, are streaming. Have a nice night. Have a safe night. Enjoy movies wherever you are and enjoy life. Good night.
Good night.
Night.
It was just
Rod, you need to be educated. You need to listen to
I do. I'm
Then Frozen. Like... Then and Frozen, actually. Those are, I think, the best songs.
I'm going to have that as the transition song. We'll be Frozen. And I might open the episode like
when your heart's not open.
Yeah, I'm going to just like fill it with Madonna songs.
Oh, God, Rod. open your heart, man.
Nope. Never heard it.
I feel like Madonna is. She has like maybe a dozen great songs, and the rest I don't care about. But she has
it's the same of Michael Jackson. That's what I was saying. She should be considered on the same set of Michael Jackson. Is Michael Jackson
but
really
he has a few
that great?
More and they're better.
Look, the Motown
like, the
stuff.
The entire Thriller album is great. Full album worth of like good songs.
Maybe not.
You might have like one or two across albums, like, you know, one or two in each album. Which
the singles.
Yeah, singles.
So, I mean, with Michael Jackson, after though outside of Thriller, does he maybe Off the Wall? Does he have like we're not going to count the Motown stuff that isn't Michael
Bad,
Jackson
Bad
solo.
Bad was pretty good. I liked Bad. Bad
Smooth Criminal's his best song, and it was covered better by Alien Ant Farm.
Oh, it was not.
Yeah, it's Alien Ant Farm version.
No, it was not
Michael Jackson version.
Just so you know, this is the opening of the podcast, so everyone's going to know what you believe about Alien Ant Farm. Are you ready to stand by?
Yeah,
it's fine. And the video clip was amazing. I will die on that hill.
Glenn, do you also believe that Fall Out Boy covered Beat It better than the original?
I don't think I've heard the Fall Out Boy version. Okay. And I don't know who that is. All right. Tenet. Should we
okay,
talk
so
Tenet?
This movie, Tenet.
We're doing spoilers. We're going to do spoilers. This is a no holds barred spoilers discussion for the Christopher Nolan film Tenet. You have been warned.
Before we start discussing spoilers, Virat, what did you think?
Yes. Okay.
And you can spoil it as you do, because we have that luxury.
But the thing is, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the fact that this was the first movie I saw in cinema since March. And it was a nice, big spectacle. I had the same issues that Chris had with sound mixing and trying to comprehend dialogues.
Why does he do this? Someone last night asked me, okay, so Tenet, how's the sound mix? And it's like, yeah, you can't hear people. Sometimes they're wearing masks, you can't hear them.
And this was exacerbated in this movie because at least for one third of the film, someone or the other is wearing a mask of some kind. Or it's either an oxygen
wear
mask.
Wear a mask,
or
just not when
the
you're...
The thing is, where the ADR dialogue. Is a thing. Sound mixing... is very precise. Wearing a mask should not be a reason that you can't hear what someone's saying. And there are scenes where people aren't wearing masks where you also can't hear what people are saying. What is Nolan's thing?
The
is,
sound
he like
the
power
wave.
Over his audience? Like, yeah, you can't understand that, can you? You're gonna watch that again.
We're gonna create an impression.
Understand, yes. I've got you.
In the beginning, the scene in the boat, the sound of the waves was louder than the dialogue. And I'm just like, this makes no sense.
He does it every time. He pushes the sound effects louder than the dialogue to the extent that you cannot hear it. And, you know, last night, watching Knights of Kaviria at the Ritz, I was unfortunately up against the back wall and Tenet was playing next door. So periodically through the film, the wall would just rattle.
Yeah.
When you could tell he was doing his classic Nolan bass farts.
Yeah.
it gets better later in the film. The first half, it's just a little jarring. I think he's trying to, I'm not saying this is an excuse, I think it's poorly done. I think he's trying to create an impression rather than inform the narrative and create an aesthetic experience. I don't think that it was the time in a film that is so dense, but also when it's imperceptible to the point that it brings you out of the film rather than creating a milieu in which to enjoy it.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed the first half. I enjoyed the setup a lot.
The spy movie stuff.
The spy movie stuff, it was very Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. It was very much...
It's also very James Bond, right? Things.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah,
more James serious Bond. James Bond.
Yeah. It felt like John David Washington felt like he was embodying, George Smiley and Jason Bourne in one kind of a mix, which is a nice thing to kind of thing. I mean, but he doesn't have the gravitas to actually pull it off, but he has the physicality to do so. So I did buy him in the action sequences quite a lot. It was actually wonderful to see how he could do that. Can you guys still hear me?
Yeah.
Cool, sorry, because I thought my earphones just tried.
No, it's all good.
Yeah. So that was a lot of fun. But I was really thankful for Robert Pattinson because he was the only saving grace in terms of humor in the film. And boy, this film needed a bit more humor. It was so self-serious. All the bloody
It's very time. Serious. And it feels very dark. It makes like the massively serious tone that Nolan brings to things means that when you just go through the general, like here's the bit where the bad guy is more on top part of a movie that happens in every blockbuster. But usually you just sit down and you're like, yeah, it's fine. It feels crushingly dark. It's like so, oh God.
Kenneth Branagh, like that role is a Bond villain. It's Gary Oldman in Hitman's Bodyguard, but he's taking it so goddamn seriously. Mm. Like when he said, like, there should be at least a tinge of humor to a line like, I am a god. But
Nolan is treating everything really seriously. Washington sucks at the quips. And he sucks at the bits where it's time to like sincerely emote. Because Pattinson nails both of them, and it's just why is Robert Pattinson not the lead?
I mean, one of the most sincere emotions or sincere scenes in the film, or the moments in the film, is with Robert Pattinson. I mean, the final sequence was probably the only time I felt anything emotionally.
Me too. You know,
apart from
but it was so staged. Like, don't worry, we'll see each other again. Don't worry, I'll see you again. But I have to walk over to the sunset. But wait, sorry, there's a sunset waiting for me. I have to go.
I still thought it was nice.
But I was glad it was shot from John David Washington's point of view. So we were mostly seeing Robert Pattinson. Because if it was a reverse shot and John David Washington had to emote that, I would be like, boss, dude, your face has no emotion. You are
he's bad.
Just like
he's wooden. He's really wooden when you see him trying to be like, oh, yeah, I'm a dashing spy, and here's my quips.
That was the brief that he's so stoic and he's basically, you know, being roughened up by the spy world. So
he has to be a cool guy as well in this movie, and he doesn't do it. For me,
he does not do it.
He has the only arc he has is. It's the Eggsy arc. I don't like stuffy double-breasted suits. Oh, but now I do because I'm now a super cool spy.
Michael Caine was funny.
It's so extraneous.
But the whole thing of like Nolan, the stuffiest Englishest guy ever, and now I'm LA. I'm going to do jokes about Brit. Oh, I'm the Brit stuffy. Come on, man.
Like the bit where he's carrying the tea through the safe. In the suit, that's Nolan. Like that is him. As mentioned last week, the hilarious footage of Chris Nolan at a rap gig. I think it was MTV.
Right.
Yeah, granted, I can't name the artist, but yeah.
But he was like bopping weirdly. You were telling me
that would be me too. Don't worry. But right. But Nolan's trying to say, no. I'm the with all of the cool kids. I like all of the cool kids.
The thing, I still overall, even though it's fun to diss this film, I still overall look at it like this is cool. You know,
I enjoyed this more than Interstellar and Dunkirk.
Oh, dude, for sure. I would say this is definitely his best movie since Inception. I think it's quite as good as Inception, but not that far off.
It's still more fun than Inception. Like, you know, I like the
maybe similarly.
The action is much more coherent in terms of
the action in this is really good.
Yeah.
Nolan has gone leaps and bounds as an action director.
I would say Inception is fun just because the heist format works better there. Because they're all like working towards a much more clear common goal and they all have different tasks, where here it's all just a little jumbled.
I agree. But still, I did find structurally it was easier for me to buy into the action because of the setup in how everything was established in the first half, and when things did get inverted, it was logical in the way that the action was set up. So like it was still, and the shtick didn't get old. So that was
a lot. Yeah,
there was enough variety in there for me to be like, okay, cool. So this is not this way. This is not this way. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that the film takes its time with setting up the world before any crazy sci-fi
stuff. Yeah, it didn't treat it like a gimmick, which is great. Like, it did sort of like, we're going to build this up. We're going to tell you the rules. There's going to be an info dump, which is classic in every Nolan movie. Everyone's going to try to explain you with philosophical meaning about what it is all about, what time travels mean for the humanity and meaning of life and the grandfather's paradox, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, you know.
Which we're not going to address. We'll pretend we'll address it by not addressing it. We will not address it by addressing it.
Okay, it does address it. This is really the spoiler territory. The film, it takes the Star Trek Discovery approach where time doesn't, if something already has already happened, and that it seems to imply that if someone goes back in time, the previous timeline where all they'd actually gone back in time ceases to exist. So that's okay, but it still doesn't address some of the intricacies and paradoxes that this film implies, because it seems to indicate that there are or otherwise have been times where that hasn't happened. But then again, the bit in the airplane
just
where
it
himself, where he's jumping off the ship, it seems to have all happened. But then that takes out, but it takes away the idea of fate. You can create your own fate, which is a driving force of the film. So that's where the contradiction lies. And it takes away, I think, some dramatic effects of the movie. Again, I'm happy to rewatch it and revive
the movie.
But that's where it's between, like, now. You
must create your own fate, but also you must accept the hand that's given to you. We had some discussion on the weekend where I was saying, I feel like part of the reason why this film is being released now in terms of COVID is because...
it's got the pandemic kind of metaphor.
We have to accept our fate because it's, you know... Yeah, it's things happen that weren't part of the plan. And along the way in the mission, when they run into these freaks of nature, weird obstacles, Robert Pattinson is who knows the deal of this kind of thing, just says we have to just go with the mission, we have to just go with the plan, we need to just accept that this is the hand that fate dealt us. I think Nolan, probably, you know, watching a new mix of the film or whatever while thinking about the pandemic, probably just thought, yeah, that's really true. I was really onto something there. I think we just have to release this film anyway.
But
I don't know.
I think this is also such a Nolan thing to do, where clearly, this film is not as clever as Nolan would want us to believe, but because of the pandemic, I think in his mind, he thinks this is taking on an otherworldly meaning, but I don't think it has. But, you know, for Nolan, I think it has, which is why...
It's a spy movie meets Terminator. Watching this, I was thinking like, okay, so this is... We know that Nolan was considered for James Bond, and we know that Nolan loves James Bond. This is Nolan's James Bond, basically, for the first half. And then suddenly I thought, this is like, bring in Christopher Nolan, hotshot director who made Batman Begins. What's your take on the Terminator? Okay, what if they go back in time by living time backwards and they were moving in reverse? Because otherwise it's a Terminator-like concept.
But guys, it's not about
going back to avert the big catastrophe like World War III. They compare it to World War III by sending people back in time to correct mistakes in the past. It's like the fresh reboot, reimagined Terminator.
But don't ask too many questions, because we don't quite know how people in the present are discovering things from the future and how they're encountering that these objects and they have these other qualities and whatever.
Yeah, there's a big mystery that won't be resolved.
The matter of radiation is just very broadly handled, because radiation, no one's really clear how radiation works. So you can be a little flexible in how the tech is applied. It's not always clear. I just want to touch on something that I talked about in vague terms last week, and that's that the production design and particularly the ending. Nolan has created this world, which is really just meant to evoke a Soviet bloc era world. And he uses that terminology that it's a Cold War. He loves it being in this classic spy thriller type universe. Vrat mentioned George Smiley earlier. It's an apt analogy, but this takes place in modern day. So everything looks exactly the same. And even if we're going through different countries, Estonia, India, wherever, but more problematically, at the end of the film, he goes into what we are meant to believe is one of these old Russian Soviet secret cities.
It looks like an Xbox level.
Yeah. And you know what? These places, they were, compared to other places in Russia, they were opulent and well catered for or well maintained. We're meant to believe that after 30 years after the Cold War ends, that it's just going to be this run down, abandoned place. No, it's a place people actually...
It's a pile of brown junk.
Yeah, it looks like a video game level. It's absolutely right. It looks like...
It's kind of a boring place to stage the climax compared to what was going on in Inception.
It looks like the final level of Halo 1.
Yeah, Inception was bringing in the interesting visual ideas as we go towards the climax, whereas this, suddenly, it's like boring.
Not even Halo 1, I would say Quake. Thing. Do you guys remember?
Quake. It looks like a bad Call of Duty level.
You give it way too much credit there.
But we need to talk a little bit about the characters here beyond talking about how bad John David Washington is. Though I have more to say on that. Exactly. Debicki is so ridiculously boiled down to being a mother. It's probably the most sexist depiction of the year. The way it's like, she's the woman and she's the mom.
Female characters, just to save his life.
But I care about... Look, it's fine to care about your kid, but that's the only motivation.
Yeah. There was one moment where it was like... All life that has ever lived will cease to exist. And she says, including my son?
Oh, yes.
Oh, no. He's special. He gets a special exemption where he gets to live in a dark void.
That was what she cared about. She was expressing that. The problem is that all the men, it's fine for them to save the world because they're men and we have to save the world for bad guys. With her, he hurt me and my son's going to die. No, that I need that motivation in order to go on forward. And it's so clearly established that there is an inherent sexism to that.
You're right. Her expressing it in that moment was also silly. Yeah. Like when someone just says everything that lives and everything that ever existed. And she's like, so you're saying my son's included in that?
Yeah, it's like, I don't care about the rest of humanity. I care about my son. So like, is he included in this or not? You know?
Yeah.
What was funnier was this, apparently complicated design through which this art forgery thing, this Thomas Crown Affair element that was brought in, which is why Seder has hold over Debicki's character. And I'm just like, it's Chekhov's gun. It's like, it's kept there, but it's never used. And I'm just like, okay.
I think it's just a Bond-esque concept. He's like, Bond is always about international intrigue and the world of luxury, what's something they haven't done before, the art world and the art trade. And some, you know, he must've been reading about that and thinking how interesting this stuff is. And like, this would be great in a Bond context.
Cool. But also like,
but
before we go on.
I can't imagine anyone having like, you know, oh my God, this person has the forgery and they might out me, so I can't leave them. I'm just like, this is the most ridiculous reason not to leave anyone.
Okay, before we go on that, I just want to note, on the matter of female characters and lack of portrayal in the film and lack thereof, Debicki, she gets, nevertheless, even though it's such a limited character, one of the more interesting characters, and she's very, very good. And something I have to give the film credit for, and obviously this is all tended to her, but obviously the film was constructed so as to let her shine in some of these regards. It's
very satisfying seeing a takedown to Kenneth Branagh at the end.
Oh, yeah. It's such a terrible and recurring trope of spy action thrillers, particularly ones directed by men, that women, especially, and more often if they're larger in the frame than men, or taller, which more often than not they are. The famous example is Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart, where he was much shorter in stature, but they would frame it so they would always be the same height, of the man would be slightly taller. Here,
she's huge. James,
Elizabeth Debicki has an amazing frame. She's imposing in any scene she's in, and she is permitted an opportunity to let that work. There's an amazing sequence where she's sitting in the back of a car and she uses her foot to unlock the front door. She towers over anyone in the film, and it's essential to her character and the story that's being told. And she's also just great to watch.
She really cares about her son because she knows that she needs to pass on the giant genes. It's really, it's really important.
I mean, she's great in this, both
her emotive, charismatic, and physical presence. And she has the opportunity to shine in those regards.
I agree. I like a few of other films. Yeah. I think Debicki still got a better hand than the other female character, which is the intro dumb scientist that we've got in the movie.
She's there to set up John David Washington saying, whoa, Matrix.
Yeah, let me just explain the science.
She's the Q lab.
You're not shooting a bullet, you are catching it. Whoa. Cool.
This is James Bond, where the gadgets involve time travel, and she's Q.
Yeah.
But, you know, fair enough.
What if Q was a woman? Cool. That's it. Yep. That's the character. There's nothing else beyond that.
There's the other female character, the arms dealer, who's quite good.
That's true. Oh, yeah. She was good.
Yeah.
I had a thought the night after I first saw the film that I wanted to see Christopher Nolan's The Automaton, where it's like, it's a movie about a guy who, like, we build a robot who can expertly maneuver his way through an action movie plot. And then I was like, realized, oh, this is my subconscious talking about John David Washington in Tenet, because he's so robotic. Yeah. I think that's part of his characterization in a way. Clearly, he's throwing it back to Neo, whose role is simply that I am the main character in a lot of ways. And he's quite a bland face for you to project onto. But it goes too far here with, like, where he's literally the protagonist. You know nothing of his backstory.
Well, he's literally the protagonist.
He's credited as the protagonist. You know nothing of his backstory, which isn't inherently a problem. But then the way that he just blandly does the action movie things in terms of, here's my quips, I punch things and I do all the tasks set in front of me. He's basically a robot that the Tenet organization has built to navigate his way through this film's plot.
Yeah.
Really is that, like, the more you think about it, the more it's like, this guy is so boring. He's weirdly boring and weirdly lacking in distinguishing characteristics.
I mean, if we're being nitpicky, I would have only one piece of feedback to give to Nolan. It's like, when you're going to name your Indian characters, name them better. Priya is not an arms dealer kind of name. I'm not, like, intimidated by a chick called Priya. She was called Priya, the arms dealer.
Why not? In Tenet.
Because it's such a cutesy, like, you know, girl next door kind of Indian name. I'm not intimidated by anyone called Priya. I'm sorry, this is just how it's
And Jamie Lannister? Jamie's not a weird psychopath who goes around killing people and pushing kids out of windows?
Yeah, but Jamie's still got, like, a diabolical mess. It's like, oh, Priya, oh, cute. All right, I don't want to, you know, and then I'm like, Priya,
I did
I
not take issue with the naming of that character. I took issue with the fact that she did not get nearly enough scope in that film to be one of more, and she definitely was one of more interesting characters. All right. So we're going to be coming back next week talking all things Les Mis, we should be clear, the French film.
Not the musical.
Not the musical. Well, that is a great musical.
We'll keep talking about Tenet. We have more to say. To be honest, we've just run out of time.
Yeah, there's more to say about Tenet. Let it well see. Done. There's a lot of spoiler discussion to be had. Are we going to be doing the discussion of the past? We really want to get into some of the time travel dynamics of it. It is very complex and labyrinthine, and certainly more takes and perspectives will come out in the time we've seen it. And we're curious to hear what you and others think.
I'll just repeat the thing that I said about it last week, which is, you know, it was cool. Like, I have all these nitpicks, but I always have nitpicks. Or even more major problems about Nolan films. It's just, and I feel
this
like those problems have always
cool
been there.
Nolan film. Yeah.
It's just like suddenly he's not cool, so everyone's decided to make a big thing out of the problems that have always been there. But as a whole, this is way better than Dunkirk.
Yeah,
it's a cool Nolan concept. You know, it's nice to see a blockbuster based around an interesting idea. It was fun.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoyed it. I think it barely scraped the bottom of what terms of many things it could have done. I just, in terms of some of the female characters depicted, it's extremely strange to praise film to say, hey, you let someone stand in the frame as they otherwise might not would have the opportunity to in such a low
bar. But it
bar,
is a novelty.
Hey, it's a good thing, which, because, you know, unfortunately, and this is a low standard with Hollywood's often set for themselves, we'd often see things like this, and we'd often see films that's even that standard. So there are great things about it, but and there are strange things about it, and we're going to get into more in coming week. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy your movies.
Yeah, enjoy whenever you're listening. Enjoy the rest of your time.
Yes, whenever you're listening.
And backwards.
Yes. We'll go back and forth in this, don't worry. Good night.
Good night.
Zing.